So, ladies and gentlemen, very welcome and thank you for taking part to this event, which I'm extremely pleased to chair. Before I start, let me remind you that the hashtag for the event is LSEEMU. It is a recorded event and there will be hopefully a podcast. The event today is a third meeting as a part of a seminar series entitled Towards a Genuine and Economic and Monetary Union, What Can the UK and EU Learn from Each Other? So our seminar series is meant to reflect on the conclusions of the Four President Report, which was issued recently and covers different topics which ultimately address possible ways ahead for Europe and the European economy. In particular, the panel today will cover on structural reforms to stimulate growth, more paying for workers, and another credit bubble in the making. So it has often been the case in the past, the current crisis has acted as a catalyst for structural reforms, and reform impetus has been particularly strong in countries that ask for assistance from the European Union and the IMF. Most reforms implemented by these countries are aimed at delivering credible fiscal consolidation, pension and welfare reforms, public sector reforms, and consolidation programs. Labour market institutions and active labour market policies and product and financial market regulation have been or are being reformed, partly as a way to boost growth and strengthen public budgets. Those include measures to boost flexibility in working time arrangements and enhance flexibility in wage determination. As we all know, a well-functioning labour market is key in a monetary union. Now, the novelty in this four-president proposal is enforcement, because structural reforms are needed in order for countries to receive financial assistance and be able to implement a host of policy to target credit creation and revive credit activity. These kind of reforms, of course, will have different impact about long and short horizons. So while presenting an opportunity, the crisis certainly carries the risk that measures are introduced which might ultimately put many workers at risk and misguide financial incentives. So that will be the question mark today. So today, I have the pleasure to be in company of three distinguished speakers, which might help us to shed some light on the issue. In the middle, Lawrence Bond, she's a managing director and head of Develop Europe Economics at Bank of America Merrill Lynch Global Research. Prior to joining Bank of America Merrill Lynch, she was a managing director of Barclays Capital, where she was responsible for an analysis and projection of EMU countries' fiscal and structural policies, among the others. She worked for the OECD, the CPA, the London Business School, where she also obtained her PhD from. She made her career not only through private and public institutions, but also policy debates. She's, in fact, the author of a number of articles from both academic level and public press on topics of economic growth, business cycle, and coordination of economic policy in Euro-era countries, as well as articles on the financial crisis and policy implications. Tito Boeri, on her right, is a currently professor of economics at Bocconi University and scientific director of Fondazione Rodolfo De Benedetti. He's a research fellow at the CPR, ISA, and IGE Bocconi. He wrote several articles and books on the dualism and imperfection of labor market, redistributive policies, and political economy, income distribution, and structural reforms, just to mention a few. After obtaining his PhD from New York University, he worked for the ILO, where he also acted as a consultant. He also consulted the Commission, the IMF, the ILO, the World Bank, and the Italian government. He's also the founder of the Economic Policy Watchdog website, lavoce.info, being one amongst the most prominent voices in Italy on topics of labor market reforms. And finally, Gilles Saint-Paul, the far left, is a member of the Paris School of Economics and Global University professor at New York University, Abu Dhabi. He's also a research fellow at CPR, ISA, and CESIFO, and a member of the Conseil d'Analyse Économique. Since obtaining his PhD from the MIT, he has been an advisor to several national governments, including the Portuguese, the Spanish, the British governments, to name a few, as well as to the IMF and the Commission. His works relate to issue of long-term economic growth, political economy of European labour market institutions, labour market dualism, but also new technology and intellectual property rights for growth and dynamic of income distribution. He's been program director of the CPR in the area of labour market and the CPR EMAP in Paris. And in 2007, he was awarded the Eero Janssen Award by the Finnish Foundation, which carries the same name, and the European Economic Association for being an economist below 45 whose contribution in theoretical and applied research is deemed significant to study the economics in Europe. So, very welcome to our speakers. So I will now go in the middle, and so we, in the light of my introduction, I would like to ask in the order Laurence Bohn, Tito Boeri, and Gilles St. Paul, is the proposed policy mix of growth-enhancing reforms leaning in the right direction in the current environment, so asking countries to make labour market flexibilization a priority in an environment where unemployment is high, and to some extent also resorting on conditional financial assistance, if it's in the case for it. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm very impressed by the audience, both my neighbors and in front of me. I'll try to respect the time. I was told by Gilles that I looked more serious with slides, so I will use a few of them. And I think the point I want to make is the following. I will leave them focus on labor market reform and maybe talk a bit more about monetary policy versus the financial market reform and also the bankruptcy law reforms, which is very different on both sides of the Atlantic and I think play a great role into the efficiency of monetary policy. So the first thing I wanted to show was not the most shocking one, but just a few facts. It's true that monetary policy in this crisis has been very low, and some people are accusing ultra-accommodative monetary policy to actually create bubble and allow people to defer structural reforms. When we look at this, we can see that the sovereign bond yields, which is the top left-hand side chart, they're effectively very low. They're not very low everywhere, because if you look at Spain and Italy, for example, they're back at the level they were at the beginning of the Eurozone. If we look at bond yields, they have come down significantly, much more than they've ever been, and that may be where you can see spot for bubbles. It's a bit different when we look at the interest rates, which are given by bank for lending to SME, and here again we will find some what people call evidence of fragmentation, with the south of Europe paying a bit more than the north of Europe when they borrow from a bank. So that's one hint that monetary policy does not work the same everywhere. And finally, when we look at mortgage lending rates behind me, you will find the same type of discrepancy. So rates are low. They have been low for a number of years, and they do not work in the same way throughout various countries. Does this ultra-accommodative monetary policy create bubble? I would argue it's difficult to say yes today. It is true that we have seen worrying signs of a bubble. What you have on the left-hand side is the cumulative flow of funds into bonds versus equities since the years 2000s. And you can see that in 2008, following the development of the crisis, there has been huge variation, right? So the liquidity has gone into bonds and gone away from equity. It's in the process of changing a little bit, but it's very minor. I would say that, yes, excess liquidity has to find a nest. At the same time, regulation is partly responsible for this excess liquidity moving into bonds and away from equity. And that's something which we haven't talked enough about, I think. It's also the case that when people are seeking yields, which is this chart here, then yields in emerging markets have come down dramatically. I would argue that with the Fed tapering, we are seeing a reverse of this in the countries that have weak fundamentals. So in both cases, like in the first slide, the point I'm trying to make is, yes, ultra-accommodative monetary policy yields to very low rates, possibly misallocation of money, but the fundamentals of the economies matter, and the regulation matter. This is true for the allocation of liquidity between equity and bonds. It's also true when you look at the impact that a reduction in the accommodation of monetary policy may have on country. And then this ultra-low monetary policy has worked very differently across regions. We saw a revival of economy in the US and in the UK, where growth rates are now going to be back towards trend or slightly above. in Europe we're still in negative territory. We might go into positive one next year, but this will be feeble. And unemployment has reacted very differently. Since in the US and the UK it's going down markedly, in Europe it's obviously remaining too high. Again, I think the fundamental and the structure of the economies are partly responsible for that. Transmission of monetary policy is uneven, and this results in very uneven results. On the face of the European real economy outcome, you could argue that monetary policy has not been accommodative enough, or at least the accommodation of monetary policy has not been efficient as it has been in the US and the UK. And that's where I think we can make a link with some of the structural fundamental differences in the economy, and the one I want to focus on is indebtedness. And I think that's a marked difference between what happened in the US and the UK on the one hand and what happens in the Eurozone on the other hand. There has been virtually no deleveraging in the Eurozone. There has been quite marked deleveraging in the US and the UK, which you see most on the household side. This, I think, is due to two factors. The first one is bankruptcy law. If I want to be very schematic, in the US, when you can't pay your mortgage, you give back the key, you walk out, there's no stigma. If you're a firm, you go under Chapter 11, you go into bankruptcy, and you can start again the day after. In Europe, it's very different. You pay your debt, right? And no matter what happens, whether you're a firm or a household, you're sticked with your bad loans. And because the banks also are weak, and in the US and the UK at the beginning of the crisis there was forceful action to force the bank to restructure, and there was not so much in Europe, there was virtually none. In Europe, the capital structure of the banks remain weak, so they have a vested interest not to take losses from bad loans, meaning you have households and firms trying to renegotiate with the banks because they don't want to go bankrupt on the one hand. And then you have the banks, which have an interest in not writing down losses because they're weak. So you get this rolling of bad loans, which means that people do not go through the deleveraging, and the banks remain impaired and unable to lend and unable to transmit the ultra-accommodative monetary policy. So where does that leave us? I think there are two things. The first one is the ECB becoming the single supervisor will force the bank restructuring, hopefully. My neighbor might disagree with this, but should force the bank restructuring that will make both people, firms, and them write bad loans and start with a cleaner balance sheet. And until we see that, the extent to which monetary policy is accommodative will not fully work. And at the same time, you could argue, when you see this type of unemployment rate, that the policy mix should do everything it can to kickstart the economy anyway, because otherwise the structural rate of unemployment will remain elevated, the investment ratio, which have come down for the past 5 to 6 years, will remain low, and trade growth will continue to fall. And I think I will stop here and leave my name.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here this evening. As Laurence has been talking very much about financial markets, I think I will talk more about flexibility in the labor market, and then Gilles will clearly talk about interaction between the two. Interaction. So do we need the flexibility now? Well, if we take, besides, you know, the report of the four presidents, if you take the position of perhaps, you know, the only supranational authority today existing in Europe, so basically the words of the president of the ECB, it would seem to be the case, and particularly not taking reports, but, you know, statements that are supposed to really put pressure on governments. The letter that supposed to be a letter not to be disclosed to the general public, but as usually things got disclosed in Italy. You know, secret letters are never secret in Italy. So the letter was signed by Mario Draghi and Trichet in February 2012, said this. We consider the following measure as essentials. A thorough review of the rules regulating the hiring and dismissal of employees should be adopted. So that was a clear message that Italy should had to revise the regulation concerning these missiles. And indeed, since then, the government, Monti government, tried hard to reform the so-called Article 18, which is an article of the labor code that really put very strong cost to dismissal, basically, because it imposes the reinstatement of workers being unfairly dismissed. They didn't do that at the end of the day, but there was a major effort, and the point that was made it was that this was the ECB recommendation. So is it good to do that? My answer would be that I'm not sure that we need to do that in to get more labor market flexibility. At least we don't need to do that in all countries and for all contracts. One has to proceed on a case-by-case basis and find out when this type of intervention is needed. There is one thing that is very important and was highlighted by this recession. The fact that different countries tend to have a different responsiveness of labor market to the same shock, broadly speaking. In economics, we do study and we do empirically estimate Okun's law. Okun's law are basically a relationship, offer a relationship between the dynamics of output and GDP on the one hand, and on the other hand, you may do that in terms of unemployment or in terms of employment. And there is the famous beta coefficient, which is the coefficient linking indeed the size of the output fall to what happens to the labor market. Now, it turns out that there is a huge heterogeneity in this beta coefficient, and there are countries where the beta coefficient is relatively small, and other countries where the beta coefficient is particularly large. Among those which have a high beta, so a strong responsiveness of unemployment to changes in output, there are many of the so-called dual countries. The dual countries are countries like Spain, in which you do get, on the one hand, fraction, a significant portion of employment, or dependent employment, which is under temporary contracts. About one third of dependent employment in Spain is under this type of contract. Alongside the other workers, dependent employees, who are under the open-ended, permanent, so-called regular, if you want to call them, a contract that are very strongly protected. So there is a coexistence of these two regimes within the same market, and what happens is that you get really a lot of flexibility on this fringe of temporary contract, while the other component of the labor market is completely insulated from the shock. What happened to the construction sector in Spain, in my view, is particularly enlightening. During the recession, the construction sector, you know, following the housing boom, lost some 30 to 40% employment. All of these persons losing a job were before contractos temporales, so workers under temporary contracts. The workers who had, at the beginning of the recession, a permanent contract in Spain actually enjoyed an increase in wages. So there is something fundamentally wrong in a labor market in which all the flexibility is concentrated on a narrow segment, those holding this temporary contract, and the other workers, those with permanent jobs, are completely insulated, and they can also get some increase in wages. This is bad, clearly, from an equity standpoint. It's bad, generally speaking, because also from a human capital standpoint, because typically these are young people you need to invest more, and typically firms were investing in these people in the past, so you want to really have some training of a job, and clearly this is lost because they are used more as a buffer stock than anything else. But there is also something wrong from the macroeconomic standpoint, because clearly you have not really the operation of the adjustment mechanism. So, you know, the typical Phillips curve type of thing, where you get that unemployment reduces wages and then you get adjustment along the price, wouldn't take place in this case, because clearly you have these two different segments. So more than really working on flexibility by itself, I think in all of these countries what you need is more to work on the segmentation of the market and try to unify as much as possible the market. So that is, I think, what should have been done also in Italy, and in a way was missing from this recommendation of Draghi. There was something else, though, in the statement by Draghi, and I want to read. It was also later on was stated that there was a need to establish an unemployment insurance system. And, you know, that is a message instead that I think has some important role to play. So basically, there are two common ways to protect workers against uninsurable labor market risk. One is to have this very strict regulation on dismissals, and the other way to do that is to provide income replacement to people losing a job, so unemployment benefits. I think that the common wisdom at the European level by now is that we should move from a system that was protecting workers on the job to a system that protects those losing a job and providing income replacement and easing the mobility and the relocation of workers. This is also due to the fact that globalization put a lot of pressure for relocation, for changes in specialization, and you want to do that at the lowest social cost as possible. However, the problem with this type of reform is, and I think is moving in the right direction, is that not always you succeed in doing this reform, so reducing cost of dismissal for permanent contract and increasing the generosity of unemployment benefit for two reasons. One is a political economy one, and basically the fact that the workers with a permanent contract, open-ended contract, are those that are mostly represented in the political process, are those that are more unionized. So at the end of the day, you end up always concentrating all the search for flexibility on this narrow segment of workers, and the young workers was not represented, and then you create this dual system that have all the problems that I was mentioning before. And the other is a fiscal reason. The countries that would need the most at this juncture to do this type of reform, so replace EPL with employment protection legislation, with unemployment benefit, are the countries that have more problems in terms of the public debt. And clearly, the creation of an unemployment benefit system, especially during a downturn, is very costly from the standpoint of public finance. So this is clearly something that is making all of this adjustment more difficult. Last thing, there is another dimension that has not been thoroughly investigated, and but very important as we learn from this great recession about flexibility. And this flexibility is the one that is on the hours, on the intensive, we call it intensive margin. So you not need only to adjust employment along the extensive margin with the laying off person and having employment adjustment person leaving and being replaced and changed. You can have a certain amount of adjustment, especially if the shock is temporary, taking place only along the hours dimension. There was a rediscovery during this recession of short-time work schemes, subsidized short-time work schemes, led mainly by Germany, but also other countries had an experience in this respect. I think that it's very important to look thoroughly at that. The important lesson we learned from this is that really these schemes should operate as temporary schemes. They should only encourage employers to try and see whether there is scope for hours adjustment, but cannot clearly be a way to deal with structural problems, because then they, in a way, prevent the type of mobility that it would be desirable. A very final thing. There was no reason to think, and this is a message instead in general, from a macro standpoint, for doing something about the labor market and unifying the labor market, overcoming the segmentation, removing the rigidity that exists in wage setting and labor market adjustment when this is the case in some segment of the labor market. The countries that have, it's not said a priori that the countries that had experiencing more problems in terms of labor productivity growth and also total factor productivity growth before the Great Recession would have been those that would have been suffering the most during the recession. But this is exactly what has been going on. Most of the countries that, if you look at the entire period 2008-2012, you see that the countries that were, having the worst economic performance before the recession have been those that have had the largest falls in output and have not yet recovered from this fall. So I think the issue of flexibility in the labor market is important. The thing is, to discuss it in a proper way and to really try and find the what should be done specifically in different countries and depending on the different type of contact. It should not be something that there is not a one-size-fits-all principle there. You really have to look at the details of the situation in the different countries. But in general, it is important to get more flexibility in the labor market if you want an answer, and protection being provided via unemployment benefits. But you have also to take into account the constraint that I was mentioning before.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Okay, thank you. So I'm going to address the issue of Frankfurt consensus or Brussels consensus. Traditionally, when the IMF was dealing with a crisis in Latin America, there was the Washington consensus. And now with crisis in Southern Europe and Ireland, we have mostly Southern Europe, we have the Brussels consensus. And the Brussels consensus is, we're going to give you money, we're going to give you liquidity adjustment, we're going to buy your bonds at a reasonably low yield, but in exchange for that, you're going to do a bunch of structural reforms. Okay? So this is the the deal, and therefore we have a sort of standard package which is a mix of short-run fiscal adjustment, increasing taxes, better compliance in paying taxes, perhaps reduction in public expenditure, and at the same time we have long-run structural reforms such as changes in employment protection, changes in bargaining systems, the deregulation of services, taxes, regulated professions, retail trade, and so forth. So the question is, in my view, what is the rationale for this Brussels consensus? Does it make sense? Is it consistent? Or is it just, lunacy? And if you ask yourself what's going on, people have been talking about structural reforms for decades. Before the crisis, the OECD, the European Union, the IMF, maybe not the UNESCO, but almost, were writing reports saying, you need to do more structural reforms. And during the crisis, they continue to write reports saying, you need to do more structural reforms. Now, I'm a big partisan of structural reforms, but the question is, what do they have to do with the crisis? Because the crisis in Europe is mostly a fiscal crisis, and conceptually, a flexible economy can be managed by a fiscally profligate government. Actually, the United Kingdom is a pretty flexible economy, and I think if you look at budget deficits in the United Kingdom, it's not particularly, does not look very responsible, at least until recently. And conversely, you could have a rigid economy that can be managed by a fiscal conservative, like, Ceaușescu, Romania. That was a very rigid economy. I'm not sure there was much economic freedom. Lots of things were regulated, and yet Ceaușescu decided to pay back the entire external debt of Romania, so it was a very fiscally responsible economy. So at face value, structural reforms and fiscal adjustment are two things that are more or less, at the first level of approximation, orthogonal, and so it's not obvious what is the rationale for this Brussels or Frankfurt consensus? In fact, some people complain that, it's a bad idea to have structural reforms during the crisis because they reduce demand, and therefore, it's part of the general critique against austerity. If you have austerity, you have demand is low, people lose their jobs, tax receipts are low, and therefore, if you do austerity, you are in fact shooting in your own feet. What we should do is what Krugman says, which is 10% budget deficit, because this will, you know, bootstrap the economy out of the recession. Now, I'm not going to defend the Krugman view, which I think is crazy, but we have to be sort of more subtle than the across-the-board Brussels consensus in assessing whether we should do structural reform or not. It depends on which structural reforms we are talking about. And in fact, I think the expression structural reform should be maybe banned from our vocabulary because it's a catch-all phrase and there are many things that can be lumped in these structural reforms. In fact, the French government sometimes makes the labor market working, you know, in a worse way than it used to, and then they go to Brussels and say, look, you know, we have done structural reforms. We have prohibited half-time employment, so, you know, this is our structural reform. So, essentially, it's important to think about how desirable it is to implement this or that structural reform during a crisis, and it depends on which reform we are talking about. Talking about employment protection legislation, which maybe does not have a big consequence on the headline unemployment rate, but certainly raises unemployment duration and implies and has negative consequences for growth. What we know is that in the short term, when you make it easier for firms to get rid of their workers, they are going to get rid of all the workers that they wanted to get rid of in the first place, but couldn't because these workers were protected. So there is always a sort of, you know, job loss overhang out there. There are firms that are in a bad situation are always keeping more workers than they want because of employment protection. And of course, you don't want to dump people on the labor market during a recession. And so it's actually not the right timing to reduce employment protection provisions during a recession. You want to wait until the macroeconomic conditions are such that the people who are going to lose their jobs because of the structural reform will find another job quickly. So that's one example of a reform that we should not do during a recession. On the other hand, what we have observed in some countries, Spain, I think Greece to some extent, is that some reform, there has been some reforms of the collective bargaining system by, you know, having a more decentralized collective agreements. Instead of having wage bargaining at the sectoral level, you have more scope for wage bargaining at the firm level. And this increases wage flexibility. And this is actually, in my view, although this is a matter we could debate that, but in my view, I think it goes in the right direction because if you have more wage flexibility during the crisis, then you have a quicker adjustment you have a quicker adjustment of the composition of aggregate demand in particular between internal demand, which is too high in the first place, and exports. So the more flexible your wages are, the more you can survive with a single currency. And the fact that this takes place in the recession is in fact speeding the adjustment. And that's a good thing. Now, many people tend to argue that if you make wages more flexible, then wages will fall, and this is bad for consumption. I think this argument is a little bit overstated because, well, there may be that effect, although, you know, it's not straightforward because you need workers to consume more than capitalists in order to make this case, and I'm not sure, I mean, there's no a priori reason why this should be the case. But on top of that, there are other effects, because if wages are more flexible, you have less jobs being destroyed, more employment, and this as such tends to increase consumption. If people expect the economy to recover more quickly, then their permanent income will be higher. So this will also increase consumption. And finally, firms, you increase the profitability of firms, which will increase investment. And again, you will also increase exports because you become more competitive. So overall, I tend to believe that the short-run effects of increasing wage flexibility tend to be expansionary and rather than contractionary. And in fact, if you look at Spain, the export performance of Spain has recovered spectacularly and unexpectedly. It was a big surprise, at least to me, during the crisis. Of course, this has started to happen after wage moderations kicked in, and wage moderation in Spain only kicks in when unemployment reaches 25%, which is a very big issue. But it seems that to suggest that wage moderation does work. So basically, if you start thinking about those issues, it's surprising that Mr. Draghi, Ms. Lagarde, and Mr. Who is the president of the European Union managing Van Rompuy? But is he the one running the show? I don't know. Let's assume that it's Van Rompuy, and Mr. Van Rompuy insist on a sort of across the board. A package of structural reforms, because you should be more discriminating. You should say you should implement this structural reform now and that structural reform later. So it seems that the timing is not efficient. So why do they do it? So maybe they didn't listen to my speech. That's one possible explanation. But then there might be other aspects, which is that even though economically it's not the right time to implement the reform, politically there's a window of opportunity. If everybody knows that when the economy is doing great, the politicians don't want to do anything. Why should they take the risk of implementing a structural reform and blow it if they just instead can wait for the recovery to lead to their re-election? So in some sense, the political opportunity cost of reform is lower in crisis, and that may be the reason why there is this attempt to implement those reforms during the crisis, even though some of those reforms are counterproductive in the short run. Okay, I don't have much time to expand, so I had the last point on the financial bubble, but it's a little bit unrelated, so
okay,
I think it's better to
proceed
to a discussion.
Get back to that. No, I would like to take on your last point and ask Professor Boyer, then I will go back to Lawrence Bond. Do you think are we indeed trading off between short-term and long-term, and do you think indeed for governments might be easier to sell now structural reforms, given that it's part of conditionality, so in a sense, given the urgency of liquidity, so to say, would be for politicians easier now to pass reforms that they weren't able to impose before?
Well, this condition of emergency are typically times of extraordinary politics. I think this expression was due to Balcerovich, and it was used at the beginning of a transition to a market economy of Poland. So clearly there is a window of opportunity to be exploited under this condition by governments, because clearly it may be easier to win the political opposition to carry out reform. But this being said, I think that governments have a lot of choices to the nature of the reforms to be undertaken. It's not, again, the term, I agree with Gilles, the term structural reform is too broad, and it has been also misused often. There are many things to be done in several of the countries that have been suffering the most. And as I said before, some of the countries that really needed to do more this time around are those that were needing these reforms before. So you can be fairly selective in recommending the type of reform that should be made. One thing is to say just in the middle of a great recession, you should completely change the rules for the recommendation, the blunt recommendation we provided to Italy, in my view, was to that extent was wrong. The key point that had to be made in Italy at that point was to really to operate on this segmentation that was existing in the labor market, which meant changing the rules for the entry in the labor market for the temporary contract holders, making it easier to lay off workers in permanent contracts after hiring, and not immediately, so changing all the rules for the open-ended contracts, but on a flow basis, rather than making immediately easier to lay off the workers with. So basically you had to operate by introducing a new type of open-ended contract, replacing the old type of open-ended contract, and allowing for greater flexibility in the initial phase of a contract. So that would have been a way not to really create the problem that Gilles was mentioning before. So the fact that the employers would immediately lay off all of these workers who had been keeping in because they had this very high firing cost, and at the same time easing the entry of young workers and giving them, you know, some prospect stability there. So that would have been something that basically could have been. Another very important thing to be done is to operate along the price adjustment mechanism, because clearly, you know, the idea there is really that you should allow for wages to adjust more and prices of goods also to adjust, because when you have that type of adjustment, you know, you get less adjustment along the quantity. You know, this is the basic, you know, aggregate labor demand, aggregate supply and demand framework. So if you have P and Q here, and you have that, you know, this is a flexible market in which the aggregate supply in a flexible market, this is the aggregate demand, and here is instead the aggregate supply in a rigid market where prices do not adjust sufficiently. When you get the shock to the aggregate demand, then clearly in a case where you are in a rigid country, you would have more of a fall of output than in a country where you get more flexibility in prices. So that was, I think, the idea that behind asking for greater flexibility. But flexibility there was really flexibility more on the price adjustment. And, you know, the type of reform that had been partly done in Spain in collective bargaining are moving, in my view, in the right direction. In Italy, we have not done this type of things. In Greece, very little in that respect. Interesting enough, now we have Germany moving in the opposite direction, because, you know, Germany, the program of the Grosse Coalition is now evolving. On the one end, the fact that there is reduced scope for plant-level agreements, there is the minimum wage hike, and also there will be increase in social security contribution, which
is very good for French industry.
Yeah, that could be a good news for the other countries. So to go back to your question, I think certainly one should use these opportunities to carry out reforms, but it's very important to be less rough and to be more precise and to have, you know, in that respect, I think that the conditionality was not very well exerted by the supranational authorities in this case.
It's very important to use this time. My feeling is nobody is using the time. The part maybe from the Spanish you're mentioning, but when you look at it, the trade-off of the ECB was, I give you OMT and you give me structural reforms. And what the government said, yes, great, give us OMT and then we can do nothing. Because to the point of Jean, first, financial markets don't understand structural reforms. Right? You have to look into the nitty-gritty issue, and they are unable to make the difference between the reforms you're mentioning for Italy and the one you've been mentioning for Spain. If I just have to give an example, I still remember somebody saying, oh, there is Monti, there is structural reforms. Are you revising your Italian growth forecast? No. No. Why? It's not going to have any impact now. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, I think the ECB has bought time and the situation is stable, but the situation is not stable because countries are doing the reforms. The situation is stable because there is not one investor who think now they can shorten any sovereign debt. That's a recipe for losing money when you know that the central bank is there with all its printing machine.
So it's the Draghi put.
It's the Draghi put. It's not the structural reform. And I think because of the structure of EMU, since your topic was about this, it's free riding. They're all free riding on the ECB. They're all thinking they've bought time. At some stage, if inflation continues to fall anyway, the ECB will be dragging printing, and that will be the end of the crisis. And I think there's a fundamental issue there with government. There's no sense of urgency anymore. This has completely disappeared. And regarding the Brussels consensus, what government are doing is ticking the box, right? Exactly like with the regulator. You ask us to do labour market reform. Look, we've done this little thing.
It's PR.
We're taxing one, take France. You have a tax on temporary contract. The idea of being sold is, okay, if we do that, the flexibility will be less on temporary contract and more on permanent. But that's wrong. They're taxing one temporary contract and there are 20 of them. So firms will just switch from one to another. And that is
okay, so, but Jules and Paul, given that this sense of urgency, I mean, financial market stress seem to be diminished, so do governments, I mean, given the high unemployment rates, then do something? Is there the sense to do something anyway? And then also relating to the point that you wanted to make on financial market and the bubbles, because first you say that some reforms might create a slack in demand, but this slack might be compensated, so to say, by wealth effect resulting from incorporation of positive economic prospects in the future, but also impact on international capital flow. So do you think this is enough to, in a sense, anyway, pass reforms which have a contractionary effect in the short run?
Well, I think people do not really understand those effects. And at least in the case of my country, which is not in fiscal crisis, well, it's more or less in fiscal crisis, but it's not under OMT. there is no political support for structural reforms. It's just that we need to do some window dressing for Brussels. But then the same politicians who go to Brussels and tell them we do structural reforms go on French TV and say we are going to tax the rich and we're going to protect you and give you more money. So the attitude is completely schizophrenic. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, I do agree that growth prospects attract capital, but that does not, and this is good, but that does not necessarily create financial stability. The lesson from the Asian crisis is that capital can go away quite easily, right? Mm-hmm. And now I tend to agree with Laurence that there is we are now in for a new round of free riding. That is to say, given the Draghi put, why on earth should I, as a politician, should I risk my political capital doing structural reforms or even, you know, fiscal adjustment if thanks to Draghi I can borrow at 2.2% on the market? So we have a new, you know, heroin shot or methadone shot, and it's going to last for a while until this liquidity that is being injected goes somewhere. Either it goes into goods and services and then inflation will pick up, or it goes into a new bubble and then the bubble will crash someday. So we are only buying time. We are trying to replicate. We are exactly trying to replicate the pre-crisis situation. And indeed, we have been successful in replicating the pre-crisis situation. Asset bubbles, low interest rates, and profligate governments, because they have no discipline from their electorate, and they have no discipline from the market.
Okay, so I would like to go back to Tito Boeri. So they argue that there is no sense of urgency for markets, but is there a sense of urgency, at least as far as a, say, intergenerational equity issue is concerned, than to do reforms?
Well, the fact that the Great Recession left a very heavy legacy for especially the young generation is quite evident. We do have not only the fact of youth unemployment, which is again not something uniform across the board, because clearly the differences in this respect are wide. You know, you have countries like Germany and Austria where youth unemployment is extremely low, and countries like Spain, Italy, well, Greece, clearly where youth unemployment is close to 50%, and where, most importantly, the difference between youth unemployment rate and the unemployment across the other age groups is very large. It's, you know, it's a factor, can be multiplied by a factor of 4 or 5 times. So, you know, that is certainly something that is badly felt. And in addition to that, there is this mountain of public debt that has been accumulated and that has increased during the... this is clearly bad news for the young people. So clearly there is a very serious problem in that respect. And... I'm afraid that I have to say that in this respect there is a problem of the authorities, you know, the horizon of the policymaker clearly is an issue that prevents, and also the fact that the median voter is aging very rapidly, so prevents the due action in this respect. But also there is the fact that, after all, the type of policy that should be done to deal with this problem are national policies, and are policies that must be somewhat different across countries. So certainly there is a message from Brussels that is lost in translation, and there is a total disconnect between the Brussels language and the type of things that are being said in all of these meetings, tackling the European youth unemployment problem and what is done at home. But it is true that in the single countries you need to do different policies. You know, it's because there are a number of things that are specific in terms of the design of pension systems, in terms of the transition from school to work, in terms of and there you really need to do more. So going back to the issue of the conditionality, in my view, it's true, but the conditionality was partial in this case. Draghi had some bargaining power before, actually, opening up the LTRO or the OMT programs. Once they started buying government bonds, clearly the conditionality was gone. It was not credible that it could stop, you know, the process simply because one country was not complying with the agenda of structural reforms, and there is no evidence this never happened anywhere. But also I think a mistake was made in not trying to really tailor the recommendation to the specific national circumstances. Now, perhaps we don't have supranational authorities in Europe that are capable of identifying specifically what should be done in different countries. So they don't really take into account this huge heterogeneity that we do have in Europe. Europe is extremely heterogeneous. The ratio of the unemployment rate between from the largest, I think if you go from Spain to Austria, we go from 50 or, you know, we go now from 25 to 3% unemployment rate. Income per capita is completely there. Also, the difference is income per capita across countries, there the difference between is much larger than in the US. So it's what a supranational authority willing to exert conditionality should not be stating the same thing for all countries, should really go in the detail of each single country. So this opportunity was lost. You know, this conditionality was badly used, in my view, during the recession.
So, Lawrence Bond, do you think that, in a sense, financial market at some point will realize, I mean, now they're, in a sense, quiet because of these liquidity hangover, as we realize, but would that last forever? So would financial markets still believe that, in a sense, countries can roll over structural reforms and still get money, or would they incorporate at some point the ECB might indeed stop to provide liquidity as soon as like an appropriate governance framework is in place? So,
I think 2 points, and one is partly responding to Tito. The conditionality was hampered from the beginning, right? You had two type of equilibrium. either the set of conditions was fixed so high that it was a big threat for any countries which couldn't abide by the structural reforms, and you think you put the conditionality ex ante so you don't have to get into a program, or it was too low and then any country getting in would satisfy the condition, and that way the ECB would never have to say that they haven't satisfied. But the threat that the ECB could one day say, hey guys, you're not fulfilling conditionality and therefore I don't buy your bonds anymore, was never credible, right? So, and I think the good thing was to set the threshold high through, in practice, the threat that any program would have to go through the German parliament, so that everybody thought, okay, that would be far too difficult and let's not get in there. I think financial markets are realizing, when you look at who's buying the Italian debt or who's buying the Spanish debt or even who's buying the French debt, then the foreign investors have gone away. And what we are seeing is progressively the Spanish banks are buying the Spanish debt. You take the example for this year, out of all the net purchase of debt in Spain, so when debt, only 6.5 billion were made by non-Spanish, which is one of the lowest ever. It means that all the new issuance of the Spanish government has been bought by the Spanish bank. You go to Italy, there has been a renationalization. You go to France, and there has been a renationalization. So what we are seeing, in fact, is underneath this very stable water, you have a renationalization of sovereign debt, a renationalization of financial system. And it's the same, I would say, with the banking sector. And going back to price and quantity, what ECB has done with the conditional OMT is to say, okay, I'm opposing a price wall on you. You know, you can sell, I will buy. So the price doesn't mean anything anymore. And the way financial markets react is by making the quantity vary. They stop buying. And the question you're asking is, to what extent can the Spanish banks continue to buy the Spanish debt and the Italian bank the Italian debt? And the margin for maneuver are shrinking.
So do you think what Arin indeed should be like weight the near-term benefits against the longer-run cost of pursuing these?
Well, I think that the whole problem with those packages is that they are a little bit schizophrenic, because you have long-term objectives, which is indeed boosting growth, boosting the potential growth rate of the economy, and reducing the equilibrium rate of unemployment, and you have short-term objectives, that is balancing the budget. And some items in the package fulfill the long-term objectives, but fail the short-term objectives, like the example I gave on, you know, reducing employment protection. And conversely, some items in the package fulfill the short-term objectives, like, you know, increased taxes or even increasing, you know, tax collection, because everybody's in favor of increasing tax collection, but I'm not so sure. If the entire economy has made a way of life evading taxes, you may well have an increase in distortions if you increase tax collection. If you increase state capacity, you open up the door for future increases in taxes. In France, we introduced little tiny taxes in the late 1980s at 1%, and now the same taxes are at 15%. They could not do these things in Greece. You know, it's not doable. So. So in any case, the kind of there are some short-term fixes for the budget that have adverse long-term consequences. In my view, these overall packages are inconsistent, and I'm not sure that their net effect, either in the short run or in the long run, are the intended ones. Now, if I just can make a comment about conditionality, my impression about this conditionality, you know, structural, we give you liquidity in exchange for structural reforms, is that nobody is really serious about that. It's not about imposing structural reforms on the countries, it's more about preserving the credibility of the ECB, because if the ECB would provide liquidity unconditionally, it would be dead. So it has to say, look guys, we are not doing that, we are not shifting to a weak monetary policy regime. We are just, you know, we are being tough. So we are no longer tough in terms of monetary policy. We are buying public debt and we interest rates are virtually zero. So, you know, how can you be tough? Well, you have to impose conditionality. Otherwise, you are like the Central Bank of Russia in 1998.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the OMT is an announcement and the ECB has not bought 1 euro of government debt, not one. So you cannot possibly say the ECB has been buying government debt. It has not bought government debt. When you look at the balance sheet of the ECB, you say they're producing liquidity. They've contracted. The last year they've contracted massively. Liquidity. And I hear here both of you say, well, there is a free riding on the ECB. But the ECB is doing nothing. It's contracting its balance sheet. How can you say that? They are free riding on the ECB. What has happened is that the OMT program, the announcement, took away the fear and the panic in the market and led to interest rates.
The multiple equilibria story.
Excuse me?
The multiple equilibria story.
Yeah, I think so, sure. I mean, the market was in a bad equilibrium. It was driven by fear and panic, excessive discipline, right? Excessive discipline. And the announcement did away with this. And now we have interest rates in the southern European countries that are significantly higher than in Germany, but far away from what we have seen prior to the announcement. So I have difficulties in accepting the story that both of you have been telling us, that there was some kind of, I think you said heroin injection or something. I'm amazed. I mean, except if you say, well, the rates that existed prior to that in the markets were the correct ones, right? The markets are always right. And the ECB somehow has distorted this view, and that would be quite excessive. To make this judgment, I would argue.
I think there are two things. The first one is, yes, the balance sheet is shrinking, but it's still much, much larger than what it was before.
Yeah, of course, but much lower than in the Fed or in the Bank of England, right?
Yeah, but it's not necessarily the end of the story, right? The ECB is undertaking a massive exercise of review of banks' balance sheet, which is good. Mm-hmm. Which is good, except it hasn't got the fiscal backstop that the Fed had when it did it. So the ECB, what I'm trying to say is that the ECB is being trapped by a government. First, when it did the OMT announcement, yes, it can financial market, and that was good. And it was good, and it tried to buy time. What I'm questioning is not what the ECB did, is what the response of government has been. And you cannot say that the French government has done structural reforms. You cannot say that the Italian has. It doesn't stay long enough to implement reform.
But Jill has been, his first point was, structural reform and the problem of the crisis are orthogonal. So it's good news that the French did not do structural reform.
Do fiscal adjustment either, so, and the Italian didn't do much, sorry, correct me if I'm wrong, and the Spanish, I mean, they haven't done much on the fiscal side either. The reduction is mostly coming from the banking issue. So I think the ECB intention was good, the response of government was bad, and now what can the ECB do? Right, it's doing this bank's balance sheet review in 2014. For 1 year, total secrecy with national regulator looking into the bank with an external auditor, the ECB not talking to the public, then the EBA not talking to the public for the stress test, and the ECB trying to force the bank to raise capital or restructure when they need to. Do you think they can do that in a quiet environment? You will have rumors, you will have leaks. It's perilous, they're doing it, it's perilous. I think the minute that interbank market freeze again because you have too many rumors and banks get cut off the market, the ECB will be trapped into providing liquidity again. So I think where we disagree, or maybe it wasn't clear, is the ECB has been trapped. I'm not saying the ECB has provided free liquidity consciously. The ECB is trapped because it's got this objective of financial stability and because it's the only European institution which works, right? But governments are actually trying to free ride on the ECB like they have been free riding for years, and the fact that they have a common exchange right now, right? So there's no exchange rate wake-up call like we used to have before.
Well, I mean, there's also a diagnostic problem about the sources of the crisis, right? I mean, if you accept that it's basically a balance sheet recession that is the result of excessive debt accumulation in the private sector, then you get from this that it's good that governments increase their debt levels. They had to increase their debt levels. And this was the right reaction. If they had not done so, the private sector would have had more difficulties in deleveraging.
But governments, yes, but not banks. Look at what the banks have done. I shouldn't be saying that, but between 2009 and 2012, there was no deleveraging. Banks' balance sheet have actually increased. Right. Was that the right thing to do?
No, but this may also be related to the fact that governments were forced to deleverage at the same time.
Exactly.
When you contrast the U.S. with the Eurozone, it's very striking to find that, yes, the private sector has been deleveraging, and the government has done exactly the opposite.
Right, because the government is telling to creditor, give me your worthless piece of paper,
that's
and
fine.
I give you government bonds. We have a bubble, and instead of waiting for the bubble to deflate, which I think should have been done, but you may disagree, we are trying to replace this fake wealth by a Ponzi game, which is government debt. And many people think it's the right thing to do, but I suspect we are just, this is why I said methadone, it's just postponing the day of reckoning. And then another question is how come can the French government, whose debt has increased by 30 percentage points of GDP over the last 4 or 5 years, borrow at 2.2 points? And I suppose the answer is Draghi, even though he's not buying French debt directly. The ECB is lending to banks so that they can buy their own sovereign debt, and therefore there is no market discipline. So I don't think this interest. I mean, I understand this multiple equilibria story. There is a sort of exiting the euro risk, and this is a bad equilibrium which is priced by the market and by sort of committing to buying debt at a fixed yield, you kill the wrong equilibrium. But you are also creating the moral hazard problem that, in my view, led us to this whole mess in the first place.
To your point, I think the sequence of adjustment has been misplaced. The fiscal austerity started too early, too many people at the same time, but that's also because of the functioning of EMU, right? Rather than having a discretionary economic policy discussion about the type of fiscal policy that was needed by the Eurozone as a whole, we've been applying rules which were stupid given the circumstances.
What went on is that we, in 2009-2010, we called Krugman, and Krugman said, why don't you run a 10% deficit, okay? And then we said, okay, fantastic, the theory says we are going to fight the recession, and the multiplier is 3, so let's go ahead, 10% deficit. But then the market started asking themselves, who are these people? Well, are we going to get our money back? Okay, and then came Draghi, who said, "Look, don't worry. If you don't like your sovereign debt, I will give you euros instead." So we have swapped government bonds for bad private debt, and now we swap government bonds for euros, and we cross fingers that it's not going to that it will work. But the preceding round giving public debt instead of private loans did not work because the spread started increasing and the markets were worried.
I think the market was worried about the existence of the euro because they could see that these countries were unable to get together and address the crisis, right? The U.S.
There was a complete consensus about stimulus. Everybody had their stimulus. Everybody let the deficit slip. We had 10% deficits. And so
where?
It's not so
where?
In but, France, 8%.
But the problem was not related to the countries that made most of the adjustment in deficit. The problem, let us remember the history, you know, was related to Greece. You know, when Greece had this problem, you know, faking, you know, in a way, having numbers that were completely made up, and you know, and that started up, and the contagion was not, you know, uniform. You know, there were behind that counters and both that seemed to be not reliable in general. So, I don't think it was generally the very fact that there was the debt to be, and you know, and fiscal and expansionist fiscal policies that created the problem in general. Now, what is a serious problem now, I think, is the fact of the nationalization of the debt, because that is, you know, making the breakup more likely, but at the same time not less costly, because given that it is in banks, basically, and banks are so much linked to the public debt, you know, that would involve the collapse of, could potentially involve the collapse of a banking system, and so that is
not what if not if Draghi gives enough euros to prevent all this.
Still,
okay, maybe let's move ahead with our questions from the floor. So, Walton.
I must second a little bit, Matra Chaitli from the European Institute. I must second a little bit, Paul, on this. I had agreed with all of you. You know, Lawrence Boone saying perhaps the more important structural reform would be a household bankruptcy reform all over Europe, which has started a bit since the mid-1990s, but we thought with our welfare states we basically don't need that while the United States needs that. So but there is a change in thinking. Then I agreed with you, Tito Berry, that, you know, segmentation is more of a problem than inflexibility. Actually, we could argue in some areas we have too much flexibility now downward, which creates a deflationary or depressed economy. And then even with Gilles Saint-Paul, that, you know, the timing of reforms can just be wrong. Now, let me just defend, however, for once a little bit the Commission. What happened is, of course, that basically Germany and Netherlands and the Nordic countries didn't want to do that one thing that you need to get the sequencing of deleveraging right, which would have required to say, okay, we need to take more debt that we otherwise get through an economy that just doesn't get back growing, and back up a restructuring of our banks. Do what the United States did, and force banks into restructuring. Because the substitute then was ever tougher fiscal rules, you know, from fiscal compact to six-pack to two-pack. And then the Commission tried to find actually a way out with these structural reforms in order not to enforce austerity. Because when you read today the reports of the Commission, I think they do not want to exercise this austerity, the fiscal rules. They say, if you do a bit of structural reform, we let you off the hook. Otherwise, they would really get the economy even deeper into trouble. So in a sense,
I
wonder, my question for you is, what is the priority of reform that government should do? I mean, they are in a bind too. And in my view, it's because they are so afraid of these financial markets that have become too big for any national authority, but they cannot get them each other into making a risk pool and facing them collectively. Instead, everybody's on its own and is then frightened to death to do anything about the banking problem.
If you had one reform to do, what would it be that the government should do?
Oh, I think it's the banking sector and the debt. What I was mentioning at the beginning, as you alluded to, there's been some reform on the bankruptcy of households, but not that much on firms, actually. Today, if a firm goes bankrupt as an entrepreneur, you can be barred from being an entrepreneur for years. You're liable. You know, being penalized by not being able to run another business is just, it's destroying any appetite for taking risk, and I think that's a disaster. And the banks, you're acting that governments are frightened, but I think it's a misunderstanding. Financial markets are looking for leadership in Europe. That's what they were looking. They're not leaders. They have no ideas. They follow what's going on, right? Some of the time they are, I shouldn't say that, but use a perfect market pricing by financial market. No way. That doesn't exist. So when you look at the banks...
It's your fault.
When you look at what's happening at the moment with the single supervisor and the way that this banking sector review is being conducted, it's frightening, right? The ECB is out there looking for, analyzing banks' balance sheet, analyzing the liquidity funding model, analyzing risk-weighted assets. They will find things. They know where things. Well, they know. They did not know, which is why they provided liquidity to everybody, because they did not know the European setup preventing them from going to the Bank of France regulator and saying, I want to see banks' balance sheet. So now they will do that, okay. But if they find, say, a hole of, 20 billion in Italy, which is not completely, I'm sure your estimate is bigger than that, who's going to pay, right? If there had been a consensus about how we were going to manage this, I think that would be fine. You do it. You increase the public debt like the US did, but you put the economy back on track for growth to happen. And there again, the governments are just, look at France and Germany, look at the German coalition at the moment. The signal they're sending is no more integration, no more sharing of risk of any type.
Because it's not risk sharing, it's a transfer from Germany to structurally recipient countries. So.
That is part, because they don't touch each other either, because they've all been providing...
They don't want to fund the new mezzo journals of Europe for the next 40 years.
Can you tell me what the transfer is? I'm telling you the transfer today is from the south of Europe to Germany.
Oh yeah, well, yes. I don't know, it cost us 80 billion euros.
Because basically all these programs, financial programs, are programs where the Germans lend, right, and they are paid by Spain, Portugal, Greece, interest into their programs, and that goes to the German taxpayer. So stop saying that the Germans transfer money to the south, it's the other way around. Now you may say in the future maybe they will default on these loans, right?
Why don't the
market? That's not happened. So up to now, there's been transfer only from the south to Germany.
But people who are free to buy those bonds don't buy them.
Who doesn't buy them?
The markets.
The banks do.
Well, the national banks, the national banks. Yeah, I mean.
The national banks pushed by the national state. They buy.
I mean, the German taxpayer is not eager to lend to Greece and Spain.
But the lending has been there also to protect the German banks, don't forget.
Right. But
so it's a transfer within Germany. Right?
At the same time, they're quietly selling this.
So I would take three other questions, one in the front and then two, and then we close because we are lagging behind.
Great talks. Thanks very much. What I wanted to ask was about, going back to wage adjustments. The origins probably of the German or Brussels or Frankfurt consensus, whatever you want to call it, goes back to optimal currency theory, that if you get rid of currency adjustments, you need to have wage flexibility. And that if you move away from national wage bargaining and national central banks at one end of the Camphor's Driffel hump, you need to go to the other end to be efficient and have flexible labour markets. So this is what Southern Europe has been to some extent doing under the conditionality, and sure enough, wages have adjusted considerably, particularly in Spain. But there seems to me there's a big problem here, and we've got it in Anglo-Saxon flexible economies too. If you have very flexible labour markets, you tend to have long-term depressed wages at them for ordinary workers and depressed demand. And sure enough, this is what we're getting in Europe. And is there not an argument for saying that it would be better for the Eurozone if you had some measure of coordinated wage bargaining or somewhat coordinated signalling so that German wages and in the areas where profitability is high could start to rise to offset the need for wages to decline in Southern Europe? Because at the moment what's happening in most of the world is that the labor share of profits is falling everywhere, and this is partly to do with the weakness of demand.
Could you just reply a few sentences so we take one
second? Yeah, I mean, I really don't buy this argument about depressed demand, because if you look at the United States, where you know wages are indeed flexible, and there has been an increase in inequality, and low wages have performed poorly, but fine. But if I look at aggregate demand over the last couple of decades, now the savings rate of the U.S. is virtually zero. So I don't think that, I mean, you may be concerned about inequality. That's a matter of concern. But I think this argument, you know, we should not reduce the wages of low-wage workers, or we should not have wage flexibility because there is reduced aggregate demand, this sort of extreme Keynesian view, I don't really subscribe to it, because I think the two things are really disconnected fundamentally. Then this optimal currency area argument. First, it's a bit weird to say we're going to you are not an optimal currency area. Let's impose the optimal currency nevertheless, and then you will do the reform that will make the optimal currency theory work in your case. You know, let's do a policy that the model says we should not do, and let's hope that the model will change to justify this policy. And second, there is a lot of confusion between nominal wage flexibility and real wage flexibility. A lot of those rigidities, like level of bargaining, and are real rigidities. Nominal rigidities have more to do with the duration of contracts and so forth. And so we have to be much more careful about distinguishing these.
Then Lawrence Bond and Tito Berg on the same issue, very precisely, please.
I'll be very brief. You don't see wages falling down. You see unit labor costs falling down. And that's different because it's partly due to the evolution of productivity. But so far, we haven't seen wages.
No, in some countries, they don't.
Not
as a
result
of unit
You do get an increase, even more heterogeneity in that respect, because Spain developments are different. In Spain, we have labor productivity going up. In other countries that have just had less employment, there is not this phenomenon. So it's a different story in different countries in that respect. But you know, the idea of having more flexibility in wages also has to do with the adjustment, the heterogeneity, which should be allowed also within countries, because you have completely different situation in that respect. Now, I wish to say something also on the priorities. I agree that it should, you know, the priority should be to operate on the financial market, because the crisis was started there, and one should operate there. And clearly, in Europe, we have not done much in this respect. So clearly, one should really operate. I think in that respect, the European authorities have more possibility to operate than national government. While on the other domains we have been talking about today, the action still is in the end of the governments. And the way the supranational authorities should play this is to make the right pressure on the governments and agree with them, possibly having a good political class at the national level capable of exploiting the pressure that Europe is doing on them to do the reform that are needed. In the case of the financial market, there the case for supranational authority to taking directly the action is there, because clearly the only way to win the opposition of the big banks, of the big financial institutions, because in that respect Europe has not done anything to date, and the target it has been choosing are their own targets, the hedge funds and this type of things, rather than the big banks and the big financial institutions.
Okay, just one last question. I'm afraid I can only take one. Please keep the question short and sweet.
Okay. Hi, thanks. Dennis Shen, a recent graduate from the LSE's Institute for Public Affairs and current junior economist on a sovereign investment team. Thanks for the talk. Two things. One, I don't think we can just completely discount the Krugman argument. I think a very good argument can be made that in cases in which the fiscal multiplier is substantively greater than one, such as in structurally uncompetitive recession-hit economies like we've had over the past couple of years, that additional fiscal consolidation can have very much so counterproductive results on debt ratios. That doesn't argue for no austerity, but it would argue for more gradualized process. And secondly, certainly there has been some complacency aspects, especially this year in 2013. However, I think we also need to give credit where credit's due, which is that these countries, Greece, Portugal, Ireland, Spain, have implemented a very ambitious reform agenda of difficult and very painful changes in the way of labor markets, product markets, unit labor costs, which have been both due to nominal wage repression and productivity gains, yes, and large adjustments in the current account. And so doesn't this also then change at least a little bit your view on medium-term economic potential and the thing at the end, the end game, which is long-term solvency and or debt sustainability?
Maybe
I don't know. I mean, everybody says the fiscal multiplier is high, but I mean, think about the following experiment, right? Suppose that the fiscal multiplier is 2. Okay, you make $1 of public expenditure. This increases GDP by $2. And then in a typical Western modern economy, the marginal tax rate on GDP is of the order of magnitude of 50%. So if the fiscal multiplier was so high, you increase the public expenditure, you don't run deficit. It's self-financing. So to me, I think we are, you know, somewhat overestimating, even though, you know, I don't object to the arguments about zero lower bound and the econometrics. Most of the econometrics are done during the Great Moderation. But if you do fiscal stimulus in a period of crisis, you know, people might be worried about the future sustainability of your policies, and it may be that your estimates of the multiplier simply do not apply.
The second part of the question on the burden of the adjustment, labor market adjustment in the southern part of Europe.
Well, we should say something also on the fiscal multiplier. I don't think we can trust, you know, these estimates. You know, there is so many, there is such a large variety of them. But and also, if you compare countries in the light of the experience during the Great Recession, it's a completely different condition. If you look at Ireland, has achieved a fiscal consolidation of some 6%, and output has, you know, has been falling more, you know, has been falling abruptly at the beginning, but now they recover most of the ground lost during the recession. Greece has achieved a lower fiscal consolidation, and by now they are still some 10% below the, of even more, 10 to 15, I forgot the number exactly, GDP level. So in that respect, you know, certainly that is true, but we don't know, you know, exactly. We were not predicting in any event this type of adjustment, even in Ireland. So I think it's, and there was also an issue of credibility there that had to be tackled to some extent. So, you know, the type of the multiple equilibria story to be dealt with. So no way to avoid this type of consideration there.
Okay. So I think it's time for us, unfortunately, to close this very engaging discussion. I need to mention that this event is sponsored by the European Commission representation in the UK, which, of course, we gratefully acknowledge. So thanks to all speakers for having participated and given the contribution to this discussion, and to all of you. Thank you very much.